God deals with humanity as a parent deals with their child. I've known a lot of parents who've had some very troublesome children. I know parents whose children are in prison for murder, and they would never disown them the way some people think God disowns us.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Derek Kubelis, a Methodist minister and author of the book Holy Hell, A Case Against Eternal Damnation. This is a provocative but interesting and thoughtful book, and I was really glad to have Derek on the program to talk about it. And I hope you find it to be an interesting and helpful conversation about a difficult topic. Now, before we jump into that, I want to remind you that if you haven't done so already, you really should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness, where you'll get original, in-depth reporting and analysis at the intersection of faith and politics delivered right to your inbox. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Derek Kubelis on Holy Hell. Well, Derek, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have this conversation about your book, Holy Hell, A Case Against Eternal Damnation. And of course, we got to start with, I love the title. You know, it's
Thank
fun.
Thank you.
And it sets the book up well. I mean, obviously, it's a book about hell, but you're also, you know, this isn't a deep, boring, scholarly book. It's coming from a place of pastoral ministry, and mm-hmm. I mean, you're like very honest and openly reckoning with some issues here. So why did you decide that, like, I need to sit down and write about hell? Because that doesn't always go well for people who write about hell.
Yeah. Well,
Derek, we're done.
What really happened was, I had this experience of changing my own mind. I was researching for a class that I was teaching at my church about the afterlife. And in the midst of that, I had this kind of transformation in the way that I thought about things. And then when I actually taught the class, I saw how much pain people were carrying with them as a result of fearing for loved ones, friends, sometimes even children, that they were afraid that, you know, they lost their spouse. Their spouse was never a church person. Are they going to be burning forever and ever and ever? Or they lost children when they were younger, and now they're scared that their children are in hell, that they're being tormented forever. And these people are experiencing a certain amount of trauma as a result of what they have been taught about what may happen to their loved ones in the afterlife. And some of them are even is scared that it's going to happen to them too. And so I wanted to write a book that would put people at ease. I wanted them to write a book that gave them permission to have a hope for people, even if they died sort of outside of the faith or outside of the church, outside of belief and those kinds of things. I wanted to let them know that they didn't need to fear for those people.
Yeah, and I mean, that comes through very strong in the book. And obviously, I mean, as you just kind of mentioned, and as you write, I mean, this kind of classic dominant version of the eternal punishment hell. There are other visions we could talk about, mm-hmm. you know, other afterlife things in a moment, but you know, that's the dominant version, at least in kind of like the American evangelical tradition.
in the Western world. You know, it has been for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it does create a lot of anxiety, a lot of concern, you call it trauma. And yet at the same time, you also note that while people are worried about it, you suggest that perhaps by our own lives, we show that deep down we don't really see this vision. Here's how you wrote about it in one part, and then I'd like you to kind of talk more about this, because I think this is really important if we really think about the theology, if we actually believed it, it might change the way we lived. When we talk about hell, we are talking about a place that God created and sanctioned, where God continues to keep human souls alive in a state of perpetual hopelessness in order to torture them for literally no reason. If you truly believed that you were facing such divine madness, then you would devote all of your time, energy, motivation, and creativity to the never-ending struggle to save as many as you could from this arbitrary, sadistic God who demands either your obedient love or your perpetual suffering. To do anything less would be morally reprehensible.
Yeah. The idea is that we all live with this kind of cognitive dissonance, right? The idea that on one hand, we have an infinitely loving creator, and on the other hand, that infinitely loving creator also happens to torture and torment people for all eternity with no hope of it ever stopping, right? Now, if that second part is true, my argument is that should radically change the way we live our lives, right? We would not have secular jobs. All of our time would necessarily be spent trying to save people from this not terrible thing, but this worst possible thing. Right? There is nothing that could possibly be worse than an eternity of never-ending torment. So we would not go to the movies. We would not argue about Star Wars and Dune. We would not take time to have birthday parties or slowly sip coffee while staring out a window at rain. What we would do is we would run around like chickens with our heads cut off, trying to save as many people as possible. And if it were true, we would be right to do that. If it were true that people are burning for all eternity, it is immoral for us to take vacations, to go bowling, to do anything else during this short 90-year lifespan than constantly be trying to save people from this terrible, terrible abyss of torture. But we don't do that. And no, even, I mean, not even the most whacked out Westboro Baptist Church type Christians live their life that way. And that is because inside of all of us, I think there is a voice that says, hey, everything is going to be okay. That at the end of the day, everything is going to turn out all right. And what my book is trying to do is give people permission to listen to that voice and to listen to it unabashedly and to heal this cognitive dissonance inside of us to say, no, we do have a God of love. We do worship a creator who only wants the best things for his children. And we don't believe that people burn forever and ever without any hope.
So the good news then is if we put that aside, then it's okay for us to debate about Star Wars, because I mean, my next question was going to be, this planet is metaphorically, you know, the representation of hell, but
probably Mustafar.
Oh no, I don't want, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point in thinking about our lived theology, even if we don't necessarily are saying it out loud, we're demonstrating what we think about God and God's purpose for all of us in our lives. And yet that doesn't always align with this vision that we at least profess to believe about hell. So what happened? I mean, how did we get to this place that this vision of eternal torture has become so dominant and so prevalent in our churches?
Oh, well, that is a big historical question, right? Because I ultimately want to argue, and I do argue in the book, that that is not, in fact, the position of the New Testament. What I believe the New Testament is describing is a kind of purification that happens after death, whereby the disease of sin and selfishness is burned away, whatever that means, however that looks like, as every soul is prepared to find unity with its creator. What I want to say happened in the sort of history of it that I try to bring forward in the book is that in Greek, there were certain words that were very difficult to translate. And that over time, as those words were translated, as people made specific choices about how to translate and interpret those words, we ended up with this idea of eternal torment. That idea, people didn't balk at it. People never tried to correct it, because the idea of eternal torment is very useful for those who are attempting to maintain control over church and society, right? It is the ultimate stick. If heaven is the carrot, then eternal hell is the ultimate stick by which we can sort of keep people in line. And you see this happening throughout church history, but especially after the conversion of Constantine and on into the Western world through the Middle Ages and the Holy Roman Empire and all of that, it becomes almost like a, you can see historically the conscious choice being made to say, this is our interpretation of this. And it is usually the powerful that want to interpret it that way.
Yeah, so I mean, you kind of alluded to this, but you write it real explicitly in your book. You write that hell is not in the Bible. Instead, we have all of these other words, right? So let's unpack that, because that really is important. I mean, because I know people will be like, and you kind of acknowledge in the book, you can flip to your Bible and be like, no, see, it's there. But, you know, you know, Jesus and Paul weren't speaking and writing in English. So what? I think there's two questions. What is in the Bible, if not hell? And then you kind of alluded to this about how we got to then this other word that is kind of this catch-all.
Yeah. Well, what is in the Bible, specifically in the New Testament, is the word Gehenna. This is the word that Jesus uses most often. And it is actually a real place. You can go there today. I've been there. There's a park there now. It is a valley outside.
Is there a playground? Because I want to go. I want to take.
Yeah,
I wanna go
man.
The play,
I saw people
the playground
running.
Of hell.
I saw people running. People taking their dogs for a walk. Right through hell. No, Gehenna. It literally means the Valley of Hinnom. And that valley was a place where, in times past, people sacrificed children. And that made it this really unholy place. And so when you have a holy place, what do? You build a structure on it to pay honor to people, so on and so forth. When you had an unholy place back then, what you did was you created a garbage dump. You used it to pour all your refuse and even dead bodies, you know, paupers' graves were just kind of thrown there. And it was this terrible, terrible place that was always on fire, because fires were always broken out. If you know anyone who's ever worked at a garbage dump, they'll tell you fire is a constant concern, because the microbes create all this warmth and fires can break out on trash heaps very easily. And so it was always on fire. It was always smoky and dark in that valley. Imagine a valley just sort of being filled with smoke all the time. And there were constantly wild dogs who would be there to pick over the refuse and even the dead bodies of the poor people that were thrown on that heap. That is what Jesus is referring to when he speaks to the outer darkness, a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. The gnashing of teeth is not like people grinding their teeth in torment, but it's actually dogs baring their teeth at one another as they protect their newfound meat. And so he is trying to say that there is something bad. He's using that as a metaphor to say that there is something bad on the other side of the grave, but he never says that it's eternal. We have that, like hell, we have the word eternal in our Bibles, but when it's used in regard to hell, it's just a bad translation. The word aionios literally means of the age. And what it refers to is like the time after this life. It does not and never, scholars seem to say, never meant eternity as in a never-ending succession of moments. So you have aionios and Gehenna. You also have lots of places in the New Testament where the authors speak of Hades. Hades, of course, being the Greek mythological underworld, which is not a place of eternal torment. It is a place of it is a place where people go after they die, but there are pleasant places there. You have the Asphodel Meadows, which are very pleasant. You have Cerberus, the three-headed dog. Again, that is being used in the New Testament as a metaphor, not as Jesus is not trying to incorporate Greek mythology into his religious worldview. He's simply pointing to a kind of afterlife. And in the same way, you have a very scant reference to one particular place in Hades called Tartarus. And Tartarus is a place of torture and torment, but it's only used as a verb where it in Greek, it literally says God tartarized Satan and his demons. And what it's referring to is the way that the Olympians, Zeus in particular, threw his father Kronos down to Tartarus. It's about the throwing down, the casting out. It's not about torment forever and ever. So hell is a synthesis of all of these words that we have come up with to kind of systematize the afterlife. I would say that we bureaucratize the afterlife to say that some people are headed for everlasting bliss and some people are headed for never-ending torment. But I don't believe that that's what the New Testament authors were trying to say. I believe it is unbiblical, and that the church should rethink some of those ideas.
Yeah, and then, I mean, obviously then a lot of the visions that we get of hell today don't actually come from the Bible. You just kind of unpacked what is it. I mean, some of it's a translation issue. And as you know, in the book, I mean, a lot of it's, you know, Dante and others who have shaped our imagination much more so than Jesus did on this particular topic.
Dante's Inferno, while a beautiful book, the entire Divine Comedy is an amazing work of literature. But Dante's Inferno is probably the number one thing that contributes to our understanding of the afterlife. And what I try to show in the book is that so much of what Dante was actually doing was a political project, believe it or not. Because as he describes hell as he sees it, down in the center of hell, hell has an icy center in the Inferno, and Satan is kind of wrapped in ice around his waist, and he has three mouths, and in those mouths are the worst sinners ever. And who are those sinners? You might be able to guess that Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed Jesus, is one of them. And the other two were Brutus and Cassius, the people who betrayed Julius Caesar. And you say, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, then you find out that Dante was part of this political organization that was trying to increase the power, authority, and prestige of the Holy Roman Emperor. And so he wanted to put those who betray the empire in the deepest part of hell. And ever since then, Christians have specifically been telling themselves that their political enemies are headed for a hell of eternal torment.
I mean, isn't that just such an ironic moment for a movement that follows someone who was crucified by the Roman Empire? And they'd be like,
yeah.
Yes. And two of the top three sinners of all time.
Oh, man.
Were those that took out Caesar. I mean, it's funny, but it's also sad. I mean, I don't know. It's absolutely like, they wouldn't make my top three list. That's all I got to say about that.
Well, that's what my next book is about, actually.
What, your top three list or?
No, the way Christians have, first of all, the Christian political imagination of the New Testament, and then how that changed over time, and how it was manipulated to serve the vision of empire. So you can look for that in 2026 or 2027 or something.
Well, we need to, I guess, wrap this up so you can get back to the writing, it sounds like. So
No,
but I mean, you know, as you know, this is something important with our imagination of hell. Dante's not unique, that we have a long, rich tradition of hell being used in politics and in political debates. And you're not the only scholar who has pointed this out, but this is something that's really significant. It's used for, as you noted already, for societal control by religious and political leaders to keep people in line, you know, right? To keep the status quo and the powerful. I mean, that political controlling nature of hell, it's been a very successful tool or instrument for those in power.
Absolutely. It is designed that way. I mean, when we're talking about a hell of eternal torment, we're not just talking about a theological idea. What we're talking about is the scariest imaginable thing, right? It's not a really scary thing. It's the scariest possible thing. And it has been designed that way to burrow itself into the very deepest part of our imagination. Right? Such that we do, if we are taught that if we question certain things or don't believe certain things, that we could face an eternity of torment, that is on its own going to keep us in line. It's going to keep us obedient. It's going to keep us malleable by those in power. So it has been an effective tool. With the rise of secularism, it is losing its efficaciousness. But beyond that, though, you have this trail of trauma and grief and fear and anxiety that has bathed people's lives for centuries now. That people, how many tears have been shed over wondering whether or not spouses or parents or children were somehow burning forever and ever and ever without any hope of relief. That is the political manipulation of it is bad enough. But the emotional manipulation and the trauma that it's left in its wake is the truly horrifying part.
So, I mean, obviously then, I mean, that's a lot to try. I mean, when we talk about trauma, I mean, that takes a long time to process, to unpack, to detox. How can we as Christians begin that process? Like, what does it take to start to strip away what we've been taught, to relearn, besides, you know, buying your book and reading it, of course. What do we do to start this healing process in our churches?
Well, if I knew that, that's the book we would be talking about here today. the truth is, there is this thing that is happening now, particularly in evangelicalism. I'm a mainline Protestant, so I'm somewhat removed from it. But particularly in evangelicalism, you have deconstruction, right? And I think deconstruction at its heart is the search for how do we detoxify our religion? How do we detoxify our view of the world? What do we do with all this trauma that we've been given? And for some people, I'm sad to say that means just leaving the church altogether, but they shouldn't feel guilty about that. The way some of these folks have been traumatized over the years, it was amazing they stayed in touch with church as long as they did, you know? But for those of us who are still in the church, I think we start by saying, okay, we do worship a God of love. A God that John tells us is, in fact, love. And then we start rebuilding our theology from there. That becomes the foundation. Not the dichotomy of heaven and hell, saved or unsaved, but the sure foundation of God's love. And then we have to see where that takes us.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation, but first I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
As you noted just a moment ago, with you know, different traditions are going to have different work to do, you know, evangelicals, Catholics, mainline Protestants. It's one of the things I appreciate in the book. You wrestle with your own tradition as a Methodist and
yeah,
wrestling with the Wesleyan tradition and thought, mm-hmm, and theology about hell. And I think that's you're modeling what we all have to do in our own context is, I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, how you're still very much a committed Methodist minister. And you admire Wesley, and yet you're also wrestling with hell and Wesley.
Absolutely. Wesley was, in my opinion, the most brilliant theological thinker of his day. You know, you're talking about an 18th century guy who really brought Eastern theology back to the Western Church. In my opinion, there is no more Eastern Protestant denomination than Methodism in the way we think about God, the way we think about sanctification and those things. But Wesley was someone who was haunted by hell. He talks about this from the beginning of Methodism, the desire to flee from the wrath to come. And he actually, in his work, split the afterlife, I believe, into 7 different compartments. Like you need a map in order to really understand what he thought the afterlife was like. We think of heaven and hell, Catholics think of purgatory. He took all of those different Greek words and he understood them as different compartments in the afterlife. And people move from this compartment to this compartment, so on and so forth. And it's essentially just a bureaucratic mess. And it betrays Wesley's very 18th century desire to be able to categorize people and to be able to make sure everything is in its spot, everything is in a place that was designed for it. All the dishes get put away, so to speak. What we are coming to grips with now in the 21st century is the discovery that most things don't exist in very easily definable categories, but that we live in a world that is spectral, a world where things and people and identities exist on a spectrum. And so we're coming to grips with the fact that there are a lot of places in life where it's not just A or B, black or white, but this whole middle shades of gray thing. And we're seeing that in discussions about autism and how people's minds work, right? We're seeing that in discussions about sexuality and gender. We're finally coming to grips with the idea that things aren't so easily definable. My point is that the afterlife is that same way. That we all exist on a spectrum. We all have our own things that need to be dealt with. We all have our own imperfections, impurities. We all bring our own wounds and our own darkness with us into the afterlife. And the biblical witness seems to be that God will take care of it. No matter what we bring with us, no matter what is strapped to our back or what kind of scars we bear, God will do what God has to do to heal those things.
So you're kind of already hinting a little bit of where I wanted to go next in the conversation. And that is, all right, so if we don't have this place of eternal fire and torture, what is happening in the afterlife, right? Because if we're going to ditch hell, I know this is going to be the question you're going to get. And I'm sure you get it all the time, sure, in your church and elsewhere. It's like, all right, so then what does happen?
My contention is that what the New Testament is describing is a temporary purification of our souls. Catholics have a version of this that they call purgatory. That comes from the word to purge, to cut away. And they believe that essentially once a person has been saved, essentially, once they've been brought unto grace, that if they have venial sins, if they have little sins, they have to spend some time in this place called purgatory to get those things burnt off, so that their souls can be prepared for heaven. What I want to say is that's true, except it's true for everyone. so much of the language of the New Testament is metallurgical, which is to say it's about the refinement of metal, right? The lake of fire, right? The lake of fire isn't a lake. In Greek, it's actually a pool of fire, which any first century person would know to be a smelting pool. Fire and brimstone. You've heard people talk about fire and brimstone. Brimstone is sulfur. Sulfur is used in the purification of metal to create dross that can be scooped out of molten metal so that pure silver or gold will be left over. What I want to say is that there is a kind of purgatory that's waiting for us all, where God's holiness will burn away the dross of our lives and prepare us for our final unification with God. You see sort of a version of this in Isaiah's experience in his vision of being taken to the throne room of God. And the seraph comes down with a burning coal, right? That even the angel, it's so hot, even the angel has to use tongs to pick it up. And he touches it to Isaiah's mouth, to his lips. And he says, "Woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I come from a people of unclean lips." That burning was necessary in order for Isaiah to be in the presence of his creator. In that same way, we all have our own stuff that needs to be burned away so that we can be holy. In that way, I think hell, rather than damnation, is about purification. It's about holiness. It's a holy hell.
And as we kind of talked about before with the vision of hell, how that impacts the way people, you know, think about themselves, think about God, the new vision of the afterlife would also change our churches, our communities, the way we approach and treat one another. This is how you write about it at one point. You argue, when we jettison the idea of hell as it has been handed down to us, we free ourselves to find God in the here and the now, in all the holiness and the hardship of human life. Rather than offering anxiety-laden pleas for salvation, we can embrace others in real ministry. When we are able to look at our friends and neighbors, not as souls dangling over Jonathan Edwards' abyss, but as God's children navigating a world of pain and grace, then we can be truly present to offer companionship, community, and love. I want you to talk about that vision of what the church could be. This isn't just a theological debate, and it's not just about the afterlife, but this what vision we have of a hell or the afterlife, it really will change the church here and now.
Yeah, well, one thing that I do want to say is that it's not a new vision, but is in fact, I believe, the older vision, a vision that you see very clearly in figures like Origen or Gregory of Nyssa or Saint Jerome. That vision has always been with us. It just hasn't been very popular for a long time. But how will it change our posture toward the world? Number one, we're no longer looking at our neighbors as people who are dangling over a pit, right? So for those of us from more evangelical churches where there is this sense of emergency around quote unquote saving people, getting people to say the sinner's prayer or whatever, that urgency is gone. All right, because we know that God will deal with everyone. So number one, we can relax. We can relax about our friends and neighbors. We can relax about our grandparents who never went to church and didn't want anything to do with Jesus, you know. We can take a breath and rest in the idea that God's love is sufficient for the whole world. But number two, it will also change the way we live our lives, right? It will change, for instance, I talk about, it will change the way we conceive of ourselves politically. That if we remove this dichotomy between saved and unsaved, that's going to challenge all the dichotomies we have around who is good and who is evil, whose lives are worth something and whose lives are worthless. It's going to make us more compassionate. It's going to make us less tolerant of social boundaries and walls that we put up between ourselves and other people, because we are thinking now universally about the whole human race. Nationalism will not be as big of a temptation for us now afterward. I certainly hope that it will help the way we tend to think about race and the way racial ideas have been sort of written onto our imagination of the world. It should bring us closer together. I really believe that. But the old idea, the traditional idea of hell is eternal torment isn't going anywhere. It's not like, you know, you write this book and it changes everything. I'm not the first person to write a book about this. I certainly won't be the last. This will probably, at least for our lifetime, be the minority position of Christianity. But that's okay. Because unlike some Christians, we don't believe that everyone has to believe exactly as we do in order for their souls to be saved.
Yeah, I love how gracious you are. You're not going to condemn everyone who disagrees with you to hell. So
exactly. That right there is the biggest difference, you know? And that's why I don't mind if people disagree with it. Like I talk about how, like, yeah, this is the afterlife. These are ineffable mysteries. And I don't think, my problem is, I think, is that we try to systematize too much of the theology around the afterlife. We want it to be like our DMV, right? You got to take a number. You got to go to the right line. You got to have the right paperwork. You have to have accomplished the right things. There's nothing in the Bible that leads me to believe that God deals with humanity that way. God deals with humanity as a parent deals with their child. I've known a lot of parents who've had some very troublesome children. I know parents whose children are in prison for murder, and they would never disown them the way some people think God disowns us.
So as we wrap up, I mean, you're not just theologian sitting in your ivory tower writing this. I mean, you're in the trenches. You, as you mentioned, you've been teaching this at your church.
I'm a preacher.
Yeah. So what's been the response? I mean, how are people taking this as you push back against this vision of what they probably were taught their whole lives?
Almost universally, it's been a response of relief and gratitude. Essentially, what I think is happening with people is they begin to realize that they have been walking around with this cognitive dissonance their whole life. That the church has told them that they should worship a God of love, a God of never-ending compassion, a God of mercy, and then at the same time telling them that that God is torturing people forever and ever. And those two ideas cannot be true at the same time. And most people just kind of walk around with that tension and that pressure in their head their whole lives. And so what I hope this book does, and what it seems to be doing, at least to the people I talk to and the people who have sent me emails or reviewed the book or talked to me about it, is it's providing a release to that tension, to say, no, you are free to simply believe that God is loving, to simply believe that God is a parent who wants the best for their children. You don't have to walk around with these fears and these anxieties. So in that, I think I give people a certain kind of permission to embrace the love of God. And more often than not, they're grateful. Those who come from traditions where hell and eternal torment plays a central role in how they see the world, reject it outright, will say that I'm a heretic, will say that I'm a false teacher, so on and so forth. But I can't blame them for that, because that's what they've been raised with. And for them, they take hell more seriously than probably anyone else. And they probably think that I will be the cause of a lot of people going there. And if I actually believed that, I would react in just the same way. But I hope over time, as more and more people are talking about this, as more and more people are considering this as a viable theological option, that hearts will be changed and softened, and Christianity will become more universal in that sense.
Well, the book is Holy Hell, A Case Against Eternal Damnation. And Derek, I really appreciate you spending the time with us here on the program, but even more so for being willing to wrestle with this and put it all out there in public. It's a really important work and conversation.
Thank you, Brian. I really enjoyed being here.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordenway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordenway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook, and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordenway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordenway.org. Thanks for listening.